Dr. Patterson is currently a semi-retired pediatrician on clinical staff at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City. Born in Chicago, she grew up in Brooklyn, New York. She earned her medical degree at Patrice Lumumba Friendship University in Moscow, USSR, and a master's of public health at the University of California at Berkeley. Besides practicing medicine, she has been active in encouraging children in underserved and minority schools to be curious about and want to learn science. She has participated and continues to participate in numerous civil rights, social justice, and peace movements. So give it up for Dr. Patterson.
Hello, Chicago. I want to, you'll have to forgive me, I have both allergies and my sinuses are not cooperating. But I want to say that it's really an honor to share the stage with Katie Jordan and Bertha Escamilla and Jamie Calvin, and to hear about the work that they've done, that they're doing. When I get 90, I want to be just like you. But seriously, it's encouraging. It's so encouraging in these very kind of dark times. And the other thing is, I also want to say that it's wonderful to see so many young people. When I walked in earlier, I saw gray tops like mine, and I mentioned, gee, we need to get some young people in here. And then, lo and behold, he showed up. So it's because it's going to take all of us. So I thought about opening my talk with a joke about Chicago. And, there are quite a few of them. I went online. The old saying that if you make them laugh, you'll get their attention. But I just couldn't. Because I know everyone here is closely following the trial of Jason Van Dyke, who without cause and in cold blood murdered Laquan McDonald. I also know that it's only because of the relentless efforts of all of you and my host tonight and many others that Van Dyke was even indicted, not to mention standing trial, albeit 3 years later. So we're all watching, we're holding our breaths, we're out there marching. Despite this pressing reality, I want to talk a little bit tonight about history that Jamie mentioned. It's my pleasure to be here with you because I want to present to you what I believe is a wonderful and important book I co-authored. Now, ordinarily, I am loath to praise my own work, for like you, I've had good home training. But I will tonight, since you brought me here to do just that. The book is entitled Letters from Langston. I was going to bring up a copy to show you. On the front of the book is a picture of Langston Hughes and my mother. Because I believe the people who are the correspondents in the book are some of the people whose shoulders you're standing on today. The book is entitled Letters from Langston, From the Harlem Renaissance to the Red Scare and Beyond. Evelyn Louise Crawford, also known as Nebby Lou, and I co-edited and annotated the almost 40-year correspondence between our sets of parents and Langston Hughes. It took us over 15 years to complete. First of all, because we were doing it on our own dime. Second, because I was working full time. Third, because we lived in different cities. And lastly, because we did all the background research on every person, movement, and event they wrote about, so to provide a historical context that would create a real understanding of their lives and activities. You see, they weren't only involved in the well-known black and progressive struggles and movements and current events in the mid-20th century, but in many of the lesser known as well. And we felt it important to include those because, as William Faulkner once said, history is not only not dead, it's not even past. The foreword was written by Professor Robin D.G. Kelly, without whom the book probably wouldn't have been finished nor published. Not only did he wisely counsel us, despite the fact that he's way younger, he cooked meals for us as well. He's a committed vegetarian, but he can throw down some mean broiled lamb chops and grilled shrimp. It's a beautiful correspondence, and I don't know what you all are going to do, the tweeters and the twitchers and the shakers, you know, because this is a beautiful correspondence. The letters are intimate and gossipy. They're political and poignant. They're humorous and sad. They disclose their dreams, their freedom dreams, disappointments, victories, losses, and fun times, too. In other words, they span the greater portion of their adult lives. They reveal what a genuine, loyal, and open friendship really is. And it's based on trust and love and respect and shared dreams. There's no immodest posturing or pretense or pettiness, no lies or jealousies. There was no need for any of that. These five people wanted real answers to real questions. So they studied Marx and other left-leaning authors and journals. They also read writers of color, especially Du Bois. This studying helped them build a solid ideological edifice of radical knowledge which supported their intellectual ability and courage to analyze, debate, answer questions, and speak publicly, and defend the validity and the truth of their newfound ideas. Although Pat and Louise were on the East Coast and Matt and Nebbi were on the West Coast, this commitment to radical learning brought them closer together and strengthened their capacity to emotionally support each other, especially during the terrorizing 1950s, because they trusted that they had each other's backs, and they did. But this correspondence is especially unique in another way, in that three of the five people were at one time or another, members of the U.S. Communist Party, making this the first book of personal correspondence between black communists to be published. Now, I hasten to add, Langston was not a member of the Communist Party. Since our book's publication in 2016, another book of personal correspondence between African-American communists has also been published. And this one is between James Jackson and his wife, Esther Cooper Jackson. Chicago was always important for Langston, but he hated it in the wintertime because he lacked a warm winter coat that for most of his literary life, he was too broke to buy. Nevertheless, throughout that literary life, Chicago was like a magnet that kept pulling him back. Plus, he had many close friends here, such as Horace Caton, Thyra Edwards, Arna Bontomp, when Arna lived here. My father, William Patterson, Pat Patterson, came to Chicago in 1939 to edit the Communist Party's Midwest newspaper, entitled the Midwest Daily Record. By that time, he was well known from his role in the defense of the Scottsboro Boys through the ILD, the International Labor Defense. Among the journalists who worked with him on that paper were the young Margaret Walker and Richard Wright. He also had very close ties with the Chicago Defender. In his Freedom of Information file, that was, no joke, this huge. It turns out the FBI feared he actually ran the Defender. In 1940, Pat, as he was known to his friends and family, ran for Congress against Arthur Mitchell, the first black congressman from Chicago, highlighting what he saw as Mitchell's lackluster congressional record. He lost. Mitchell had much deeper roots in the black community than Pat did. So in 1941, Pat established the Abraham Lincoln School for Social Science. It was to be an evening school for black workers who'd arrived from the South with minimal to no formal education and no place or way to get one. Alas, it functioned for only a few years due to lack of money, despite the initial support from Marshall Fields, the CIO, and Lena Horne. Way back in 1901 in Chicago, in this very month of September, on the 9th, my mother was born. And in 1941, she returned here to marry Pat. Then, on March 15th, 1943, a rather cold day in Chicago, I looked it up on Google, Louise showed up for a scheduled cesarean section at American Hospital. Its address was 850 Irving Park. It's not there now. I think there's another hospital there in its place. She was placed in a double room with another woman. Sometime later, when my father showed up, the staff realized they'd made a mistake. Either Louise was white and she was having a black baby, or she was black. Either way, it didn't matter, because she had to be moved. So she wound up in a private room at a double room rate, and that small, ironic, racist twist became the backdrop of my appearance. Chicago, the city of the Haymarket Massacre and martyrs, of radical labor unions and tumultuous union struggles, like the American Negro Labor Congress in 1925, and the organizing in meatpacking and steel, which were mostly black in the 1930s. Chicago, the city of Mark Clark and Fred Hampton and Harold Washington, the city of Puerto Rican activism against police brutality in 1966, the city that founded the US Communist Party in 1919, the city that had a vibrant black arts renaissance rivaling the one in Harlem. Chicago means Richard Wright and Margaret Walker and Gwendolyn Brooks, Thomas Dorsey, Louis Pops Armstrong and Earl Fatha Hines, Common, Michelle Obama, Lou Rawls, Oscar Brown Sr. and Jr., Catherine Dunham, St. Clair Drake, Margaret and Charles Burroughs, Mahalia Jackson, Curtis Mayfield, Jerry Butler, Muddy Waters, Gene Ammons, Howlin' Wolf, Charles White, Arna Bontemps, Frank Marshall Davis, Theodore Ward, Nat King Cole, Earl Dickerson, Joe Louis, Oprah, Charles Dawson, Lorraine Hansberry, Elizabeth Catlett, Elsie Couture, Archibald Motley, Clarice Dunham, Claude Lightfoot, and Ishmael Flory, to name just a few. The list is really long. And lastly, Chicago, both of my parents are buried here in the Forest Home Cemetery. So it was in 1999 when my mother, Louise, the last of the quintet, died. By that time, she was the last living person from Langston's inner circle and was constantly being asked to grant interviews. She died on August 27th, the same day in 1891 or 94, we're not sure, my father was born. And on that very same day in 1963, W.E.B. Du Bois died. Decades earlier, he had been my mother's mentor. Sometime soon after Louise's death, Nebulu and I realized we were left with a trove of letters from Langston to our parents we'd grown up hearing read, then later reading ourselves. What we didn't know was whether our uncle Langston had kept any of the letters our parents wrote him. So in 2002, we went to the Beinecke Library at Yale University, to the James Weldon Johnson collection, where Langston's papers are archived, to see what, if anything, Langston had kept. And lo and behold, Langston had kept just about everything, including letters we'd written to him in our childhood and adolescence that we'd completely forgotten about. Sitting there in silence, overwhelmed by what we found, we slowly realized that this was an incredible and unique correspondence with real historical significance. This correspondence displayed black intellectual brilliance and courageous radical activism. They could have had respectable middle-class lives, but they chose to make a commitment to progressive struggle, which they knew would probably not only leave them financially strapped and socially shunned, but possibly jailed or worse. My father, Pat, was jailed for a short spell in the Red Scare 1950s. He was also threatened with deportation, but that's another story. So there at the Beinecke Library, Nebelu and I realized we had to share this discovery. It couldn't remain a private family treasure. It belonged to the world. So the letters were going to have to be published, and we were going to have to write the book. We had to write it for the Uncle Langston we had known, the one who never stopped believing that the workers deserved to enjoy the fruits of their labor and should be the ones who determined how those labors were divided up, those fruits were divided up. The Langston who never stopped believing in the imperative to struggle for true democracy in America, not the mythologized version. The America that never was, but could be, as he so poignantly wrote in his poem, "Let America Be America Again." And we had to write it for our parents who so ardently wanted us to grow up in that better world. So now I want to treat you to a couple of the letters. Louise is writing Langston, who is in the USSR, the Soviet Union. He'd gone there in the summer of 1932 on a delegation of 22 that Louise organized to make the film. And this is where that photograph is from. It's taken from the boat that they were on when they were going over to the Soviet Union. The film was never made. They were going to make a film. The film was never made. After all of them left and returned to the States, Langston stayed on to go to the Central Asian Republics. February 26, 1933. "Lang, dear, Mother slipped away quietly last Thursday morning at 7 o'clock. Services were Friday at 3, and Howard Thurman conducted a most beautiful ceremony, which was a worthy tribute of Mother Thompson. I have a sense of peace now and quiet happiness, for my mother is no longer suffering. She suffered such intense agony, and particularly during the last 10 days, it was so terrible for her, so that anyone who loved her could only be glad when her suffering had ended. Everyone has been most kind. Your mother came frequently and stayed many of those last nights with us. We had a nurse for Mama when she became so low, but your mother and others came each day and night to do what they could, so that the experience I dreaded most of all in my life became relatively easy. On the one hand, because since there was no other relief for Mama, I wanted her to go. And on the other hand, those about us helped so much. I have no plans for making any change at present. Tomorrow morning I shall return to work. In other words, I shall go ahead living as I know Mother would wish it, missing her very much, but indulging in no morbidity. The Scottsboro boys and Angelo Herndon must be saved, and one must sublimate his personal problems to the great struggle. I received your cable and finally your letter from Moscow. I'm glad to think that it will not be so long before I'll be seeing you again. There is so much to do here, Lang, and we need you. In Harlem, we have succeeded in stirring a number of intellectuals and petty bourgeois elements on Scottsboro and Herndon. We have a Sunday night forum at Augusta Savage's and have begun a Marxian study circle. Then there are many other things, and now I shall throw my entire self into everything. We held 2 large mass meetings on Scottsboro at Abyssinian and St. Philip's churches and had about 1,000 Harlem Negroes at each meeting. I hear that Matt is doing very good work up north, that was the California Bay Area, and Lauren, a mutual friend, wrote that he was trying to interest LA people in Scottsboro. Also, that he was trying to begin a left-wing magazine for Negro intellectuals. I'd like to write more, but I have no time now. Love to you, your pal, Lou." Langston to Louise, who's now living in Chicago at the only black-owned hotel, the Vincennes. It was on Vincennes Avenue and 36th Street. I don't know what's there now. Pat and Louise were renting 2 adjoining rooms and had opened them up to make a decent-sized living and workspace. For several weeks, it was a short-term nursery for me as well. Langston, in the meantime, is staying at a cabin of his Northern Californian patron, Noel Sullivan, supposedly writing in peace and quiet. November 11th, 1941. "Dear Lou, so sorry. It would be nice to be at the Vincennes. I've stopped there before, but I've already accepted Horace Caton's invitation and just had a letter from him yesterday that he's expecting me and making the guest room ready. Arna tells me that Richard Wright stayed there and found it most comfortable and protective. The main thing is it's near the L and on the bus lines, and you know how hard it is to get about Chicago in the winter. The Vincennes is miles from anywhere except you all, which of course cancels most of its other disadvantages. But I'll be down to see you and play that 12-record Victrola 12 times. You all don't know what that is. I'm talking to the young people in here. I heard it's a record player. And it played records that could break if you dropped them. I heard Dick Wright's new picture book of 12 million voices is marvelous, more beautiful even than the prose of Du Bois at his best. I am most anxious to see it. I just wrote a strong letter of protest to Dutton's, a New York book publisher, about Mr. George's joint that they sent me for comment. It's as low down a picture of Negro lumpen proletariat as has ever come out. Yet they're advertising it as a magnificent picture of Negro life as it is in the New York Sunday Times. Eula, who was a mutual friend and also the housekeeper cook for Langston's patron in the Bay Area, Eula has a soldier boy boyfriend. Did I tell you about our party the other day? It was supposed to be a cocktail party from 3 to 6, but it went on until 3 in the morning, and everything in the house was eaten up and drunk up. But the music was mellow. Nobody fought. Only thing was that one girl took and tore all the tires out of her former boyfriend's car when she found out he was taking another girl home, which since it was a big car, left 7 stranded high and dry way out here in the country in the early morning, and they had to be sent home in our station wagon. She also took his radio antenna and twisted it around like a boomerang and broke it off. But she did not break no glass. Tell Pat hi, sincerely Lang. The last two letters that are coming up are an exchange between my father, Pat, and Langston. They're both in New York, and it's the late 1950s. This is Pat to Langston, June 7th, 1957. Dear Langston, Louise, Mary Lou, and I saw Simply Heavenly. That was Langston's play on Broadway at the time. Tuesday night. Thanks for the tickets. And may I here and now belatedly thank you for sending us I Wonder as I Wander. That was the second half of Langston's autobiography. And several other books. I Wonder as I Wander was excellent. Personally, I regard it as the best of the many fine things you've done. It seemed to me that in it you were more appreciative of the impact of social forces upon people than ever before, and that the naturalistic approach that I feel often characterizes your treatment of the reaction of an individual to his or her environment was absent. The result was I saw several individuals in larger dimensions. I saw them in the midst of social conflicts in which they were caught up, or which at least were making a marked impact upon their lives. It is difficult to define my reaction to Simply Heavenly. I cannot say that I liked it. I am not a theatrical critic, but in a formal sense, it did not appeal to me. It seemed loose and not up to your standard of theatrical production. However, I was never a stickler for form if in content a piece of art said something. Simply Heavenly does not say what so greatly needs to be said at this moment, Lang, at least not to me. I'm not a prude. Some episodes of animal impulses of a person may be amusing, some valuable educationally, but some may be posed so as to reflect a discredit on a people. Then they do not prove that people's affinity to humanity, but rather the opposite. That is the way in which the portrayal of animal appetites, which almost dominates Simply Heavenly, struck me. It dehumanized the characters. Clearly, they did not appear to embody in themselves the qualities of real people. The characters ate, drank, danced, prepared for the gratification of sexual desires, as though these things constituted the range of thought and action, their range of thought and action. No idea emerges to reveal that the terrible trials of a woman with 17 kids will force her to find some outlet for free expression. That there are simply heavenly people, no one can deny. But should they not be shown as warped and distorted, and some idea be given of the source of their deterioration? Or are they normal? If they are, what are their counterparts? Abnormal? They neither moved me to sympathy or revulsion. How tremendously complex is the life of a simple. Your simple oversimplified it with all the maudlin pathos he sought to inject into it. Your use of the jazz medium to carry the dialogue along helped it to flow and gave it rhythm. That, I feel, was fine. But to me, Lang, the play was political. But the politics suited my enemies, Simple's enemies, aims and purposes in describing the Negro. The men who derive billions from our misery seek to find a justification for subjecting us to an environment that warps and destroys us to their great profit. Simply Heavenly certainly provides them with the justification. This is not the time to aid Simple's enemies when he has friends in Montgomery, Ghana, and elsewhere who are fighting too desperately to effect fundamental changes. Now, someone may argue, is there no time, no place for laughter? I heard much laughter there, and in the main from Negroes to whom the subtleties that escaped a white person were clear. The answer is, there is a place for laughter. But the question is, how do you invoke healthy laughter at such an hour as this? I don't think that you do it through an exposure of the frailties of a simple and his friends. The social life of the Negro people now runs the gamut of the social life in America. The people on your stage revealed no real desire for change. They were in the right milieu. But today the emphasis is upon change, fundamental change. The Negro people may make the life simple endured, but I would show them reacting differently to what they've been forced to make. Now, maybe that wouldn't sell. I don't know. I think it might. When Simple tried to show the pressures on him, he does it too narrowly, Lang, and Joyce lacks such human qualities as would have enabled her to help him or he her. So Simple is the product of inner forces, mysterious forces, peculiar to Negroes. He is the eternally recurring primitive Negro, so childishly simple and so simply childish. He is the poor black burden his civilized white brother must carry through life. The time and the place calls, I believe, for something else. Thanks again. One must do more than dip one's fingers into progressive life. Simple won't help Montgomery. Well, not everything can be geared to help Montgomery, some say. Perhaps not. Langston Hughes can help. He has done much to help all of us. His splendid contribution the other night was such a helpful event. Carry on, and the best of things to you. Sincerely, Pat. The very next day, June 8th, from Langston to Pat. Dear Pat, I'm certainly sorry I wasn't at the theater the night you all came, as I would have loved to have said hello. Your long letter is greatly appreciated, and your views valid in a number of ways, I'm sure. But it's the old story and the old problem I've been wrestling with for years, how to get everything to suit everybody into one piece. When it comes to plays, it's a miracle to end up with anything at all one wishes left in the play after 20 or 30 other people have had a hand in the creation, from producers and directors to actors. The problem with this particular play were legion. So to have left flying saucers in Mississippi is at least something. Several folks have expressed your viewpoint with variation, re-race, while others, as you have no doubt read and heard, take the opposite viewpoint, like Roosevelt Ward. Re-sex therein, some feel as you do. Others term it a family show and come to see it again, bring in the kids. So, quien sabe? If, as you think, it is a lulling show, maybe there's some virtue in lulling with one hand while lopping with the other. Semantics? Hey now, Anyway, there's plenty left out of this version of Simple that I wish were in. But in books, one has 300 pages to work with, and in a play, only 80. In publishing, only one editor to contend with, but in the theater, everybody pulls and hauls at a script. So all I can say is, I did the best I could under the circumstances. Next time might be luckier, maybe come out better. Let's hope so. That it gets your serious consideration and you write me so helpful a letter is at least something to be grateful for. Best ever, and hope to see you soon as work pressures let up. That show threw me back weeks on other deadlines. Besides being the most frustrating, theater is also about the most time-taking of arts. Wonder will I ever catch up? Sincerely, Langston. Yes, they were loving and thoughtful and generous with each other, but they were also sharp and direct and forceful when necessary. I believe Pat's concerns and arguments about how dangerous the seemingly innocent but humorous and buffoonish caricaturizations of black people are, especially when written by black people, are still valid. As they legitimize those images, legitimize the constant bombardment of dehumanizing images of black people and other people of color into and onto the national and international stage and screen. From there, the images insidiously worm their way into our national sensibility and mentality, subconsciously shaping our perceptions and behavior day after year, after decade, after century. Of course, black people have never been seen as complete human beings, except for during that brief period, perhaps, of collective struggle during the resurgent civil rights movement, when we forced a different portrayal of ourselves to emerge. But that was all too soon erased. So today, we're just some warped and distorted cardboard image of real human beings. We're responsible for the violence, deplorable living conditions, poor school performance, and overrepresentation of single-parent households in our communities, or so we're told. We're described as the source of our problems. And that excuses the wresting away of all of our hard-won victories, affirmative action, voters' rights, welfare, etc. So the repeated killing, imprisoning, repressing, and oppressing of cardboard images is not seen as real crime. Not only can thousands of Laquans and Michael Browns and Trayvon Martins be murdered matter-of-factly with no true feelings of regret or remorse expressed, there's no repercussions or accountability either, until today in Chicago. Because real human beings aren't being killed. So the majority of the American population need not be disturbed. It's business as usual. But racism and racist violence not only destroys countless lives, it dehumanizes the murderers as well. We are often asked what we learned from doing this book. So I'd like to end with making a point about our parents and ourselves and three salient points about Langston. Nebulu and I realized how valiant, principled, disciplined, and self-sacrificing our parents were. We read how night and day they were hounded and surveilled and informed on by the local police, by the police red squads, the FBI, the CIA, defense intelligence, and who knows who else. Their houses were bugged, the phone lines were tapped, the garbage was searched, their neighbors were questioned, they were followed and occasionally accosted to see if they could be flipped. Next, through their letters, we had the incredible opportunity to meet them in real time when they were young, younger than we were at the time we were working on this book. We saw them through their own words, how they grew, worked, played, loved, and struggled. And so our understanding and appreciation and love and respect for them was significantly deepened. How could it not be? We came to understand that from the 1920s to the 1990s, they were among the very best of the black radical tradition. And they proudly and courageously carried its banner forward, then passed it on to the Black Panthers, who have passed it on to Black Lives Matter. As for us, we have tried to pass this on to the next generations in our families and friends. And we've emerged understanding better who we are, why we hold the beliefs we do, and live the lives that we've chosen. We also grew closer to together. And as for Langston, there was the Langston who was a politically independent leftist. Aside from joining the National Negro Congress, the only organizations he joined, as I recall, were writers' groups. Most of those were politically progressive. He was also artistically independent, holding a normal 9-to-5 job only twice in his writer's life, and then only for brief periods, once at Atlanta University in 1947, and the other right here in Chicago at the Lab School in 1949. Despite achieving fame in his lifetime as a screenwriter, playwright, novelist, poet, heard on the radio, and a much sought-after speaker, he was broke most of his life, borrowing from close friends, especially our parents, and appreciative of the largesse of his patrons and the awards that came his way. He survived off speaking engagements, which forced him to be on the road for weeks to months at a time, traveling in a dilapidated automobile on dusty roads or sitting up in uncomfortable Jim Crow train cars, which were Jim Crowed until the 1950s. He kept a grueling schedule that relentlessly pushed him to a new town every day or two, where he might have to endure the humiliation of Jim Crow lodgings as well, or no lodgings, unless he landed where he had friends. This constant travel and the substandard travel conditions meant he was often ill. And that, along with his chain smoking, I believe, took a great toll on his life, shortening it to 66 years. It wasn't until the late 1950s and into the 60s that he made any real money, and then he only had a short time to enjoy it as he died in 1967. Then there was the Langston who kept his radical ideological beliefs to the end of his life. This is proven by the fact that he maintained an open friendship with our parents who were known communists. Incidentally, he also kept up with other known communists like your own Ishmael Flory, and sought their analysis and perspective even through the terrifying anti-communist hysteria of the 1950s, when just the mere hint of sympathy towards any one group or idea that was considered pink, not to mention red or communist, was enough to get one fired, banished, divorced, jailed, or pushed into suicide. Sound familiar? It is, because Donald Trump was mentored by Roy Cohn, who was mentored by Joe McCarthy, the Svengali of the 1950s Red Scare. He was the master of art, the art of bullying, intimidation, insinuation, smear campaigns, bold-faced lying, and the use of the then new media TV, which proved perfect for the popularizing of his anti-communist fear-mongering theatrics and harangues. And lastly, Langston loved black people. He loved all colored and oppressed working people, but he especially loved himself some black people. In all our hues and complexities and contradictions, our dance, laughter, walk, and attitude, our sartorial splendor and creativity, our food and generosity, our humor and blues, how we bend the English language, our beat, our strength, music, and lovemaking, our capacity to endure, our unrelenting struggle for freedom, justice, equality, dignity, and the ability to live without fear. He never stopped giving voice to his people or being the voice of his people. He never stopped assisting young writers here and in the diaspora to find their voices and to hear and celebrate the voices and songs of their people. He never stopped dreaming the people's freedom dream. Neither did our parents, neither did we, and neither have you, obviously, because you're here tonight. That dream of theirs may have been deferred then, but it has become today's agenda. I want to thank my dear brother, friend, Willie Williamson, and all the members of the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, and tonight's committee, dinner committee, gala event committee, for not only inviting me here, but allowing me to share with you this story I just told you. I want to thank the people here at Sixth Grace Presbyterian Church for opening their doors to us tonight and providing the delicious dinner. And I want to thank all of you for coming out to this humanitarian award event and to warmly celebrate once again the wonderful awardees. For those of you who would like to know more about my parents in Langston, there are books that are available in the hallway there. Again, thank you for coming out. And I just wanted to repeat, like everyone has said, we have to vote this November. We have to vote this November. Okay. Thank you.